So we're going to look today at Hebrews chapter 12 in verse 2. I'm going to read it and then I will ask you to stand with me to seek the Lord's help as we hear and heed His word today. Hebrews chapter 12, let me read the first two verses. Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So verse 1 says that we are to run with endurance the race that is set before us. Isn't it interesting that it is in fact a race? It's not a leisurely walk. You see the difference there? We are running a race. It is not a leisurely walk. If we think we're just out on a pleasure cruise as a tourist, then we are missing the point of our very existence. And we will end up being, if we think it's just a pleasure cruise, we will end up being, as the Apostle John says, ashamed before Him at His coming. We are running a race. It is rigorous. It takes endurance. And so we have to run the race that is set before us. But we do so looking unto Jesus. You've probably run before, haven't you? Many of us have been in races. We did so in school. When you're running, where do you look? Are you looking at your feet? What happens when you're running and you're looking at your feet? Something not pretty can happen, right? And you fall over, you lose stride. You're not looking at your feet. You're not looking at the runner behind you. You're not looking at the crowd around you. When you're running, you're looking ahead. You're looking towards the destination. Our running the race, our walk of faith is not blindness. We have revealed to us the objective of our faith. And we are instructed to look to Him. He provides for us an example. He provides for us leadership. He provides for us a reference point so that we have direction, so that we're not distracted. It is so important that we have such a reference point and that we have such a leader. Because as it has been pointed out, if we just simply run and we don't know where we're going and we cannot see where we're going, we don't have a leader or we don't have a fixed reference point, we will run in circles and we'll end up right where we began. Nobody has really figured out why we can't go straight. There's an inherent problem in us, isn't there? And this is why the Lord says in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2, looking unto Jesus. We need someone to lead us. We need someone to guide us. We need a reference point that will take us to the destination of our intent, which is why He says looking unto Jesus. Now let's look at this word, looking. Looking unto Jesus. The word looking means to fix your eyes on the object of pursuit. Fix your eyes, kind of like radar lock. A military concept, radar lock on the object of pursuit. There's another sense here that it's not just locking your eyes on it, but also that's implied in this is in the sense of turning your eyes away from other things and fixing your gaze only on Christ. So it's looking away from everything else that you might focus on and locking your gaze on the object of your pursuit. Now, there are some intricacies in this. I want you to consider this. Because when we trust God, there are certain benefits that come with that. There are certain benefits that just come from God in all of life. And if we recognize the benefits from God, then we might have a tendency to look at those benefits. But in order to focus on those benefits, we have to take our gaze off of God Himself. That will still lead us astray. That will still leave us wanting. I want you to, you know who Corrie ten Boom is. I want you to consider what Corrie ten Boom said. Listen to this. She said, I looked on Jesus and the dove of peace entered my heart. I looked at the dove of peace and lo, off He went. You see, is my focus on God or is my focus on His stuff? Even the benefits of God are not the focus. For me, it is God Himself that is my focus. because He alone is absolute good. You've gone target shooting. You shoot for a goal in basketball, hockey. When you're shooting, where are you looking? You're looking at the goal. At least I hope you are, if you plan on hitting it, right? Because your focus is your aim. Your focus is your aim. You know one way I know that? You're traveling on interstate, and there's a lot of trucks, and particularly like if it's raining, they do a lot of splash up, and you have to pass this truck, you know, because you want to beat that truck to the next hill. And so you're having to pass this truck, and you're kind of going around a curve or something like that. And you have a tendency, when you're passing this big rig, you have a tendency to do what? Look at it. If you look at the big rig, what are you going to do? You're going to drift right into it. Believe me, I know. Okay? I came very close a couple of times. I don't know why I'm wanting to look at it, but you have to keep your eyes focused on the road, on where you are going. You keep your focus is your aim. And so the Bible tells us here that Christ ought to be our focus. And if He is our focus, then He is our aim. A good illustration of this is the six-day ill-fated mission of Apollo 13. Never made it to the moon. Somehow they had to try to make it back to Earth alive. And in order to do so, they needed to make a critical course correction on their way back to the Earth. Failure to do so would mean that they would be off into space forever. To conserve power, they had to turn off all onboard computers and the computers that steered the craft. All right, so yet the astronauts had to conduct a 39-second burn of the main engines. They fire the main engines for 39 seconds for this course correction. And yet somehow, how are they going to know that when they were burning these main engines for 39 seconds, how are they going to know if they're staying on course? They had one small window, and out through that window, guess what was there? Earth, their destination. And he said, if I can keep Earth in that window, then I can know that we are steering this thing correctly. And that's exactly what they did, and they made it back to Earth safely. So in this text, we are instructed to keep our focus, to keep our gaze fixed on Jesus, and He is called the author of faith, the author of our faith, it says. Now let's consider this for a moment, what this word means, the word author. The word is archegos, and it comes from two words, arche, which means first, and ago, which means leader. So it can be translated chief leader, pathfinder, trailblazer. All of these are included in an appropriate understanding of this. If you were to look back in chapter 2, verse 10, the same word is translated captain. He is the captain of our salvation. Here's one way to illustrate this. In the Marines, the Special Forces, they have commandos, and sometimes they have to attack with the element of surprise, so they attack at one of the most difficult points where the enemy would consider that they wouldn't even be coming from. So this often included coming up in the water to a very steep cliff. And in practice for this, they would come up in their rafts to this steep cliff, and then they would shoot a rocket up to the top of the cliff. And in that rocket, it was attached to a very thin line, and at the end of that thin line was a hook called a grapnel. And then they pull that back gently until it grabs onto something, hopefully something secure that's not going to move. When it does, and they're tugging on it, then they have special guys that are trained and instructed how to climb, and they call them Spider-Men. And they climb up these small ropes. They're experts at it. They know what they're doing. And as they're climbing up these small ropes, they have another large rope attached to them. They climb up to the top of the cliff, and when they get there, then they take that larger rope and they attach it, tie it around to something that is definitely secure, that they know is not going to move. And then the rest of the commandos can climb up these ropes exactly the same way, the same place that these Spider-Men did climbing up to the top. In the same way, Jesus is like one of those Spider-Men. He is the pioneer, the trailblazer of our faith. He has gone on before, and we can follow Him exactly the same way that He has gone. So He is the preeminent example of trust, far surpassing all the examples that were just given us back in chapter 11. People living by faith. But Jesus is the preeminent example. That's why he is called the captain of our salvation back in verse 10. Now, there's more to it than that, but in this sense, when it says looking unto Jesus, the author of our faith, it's the same word, archegos, trailblazer, pioneer. Robertson quotes Moffat in saying he is the pioneer of personal faith. To understand this correctly, because it can be misunderstood, let me quote Barnes here. I think he puts it very well. Albert Barnes says, he is the head of all those, he is at the head of all those who have furnished an example of confidence in God. So you have all the examples of the Old Testament. Jesus Christ is at the head of that crowd. They were following him because he is the one preeminent to follow. The expression does not mean properly that he produces faith in us or that we believe because he caused us to believe, but that he stands at the head as the most eminent example that can be referred to on the subject of faith. Jesus was the second person of the Trinity. And when he was here on earth, he said, I do nothing on my own. Did Jesus have to trust his Father? Yes, he did. To what degree did Jesus trust his Father? Completely, with abandon. So, having known that, having seen that, having that revealed to us, with and the eyewitness account of those days, recorded to us in the Scriptures, our task before us, as is given to us, when he says, looking unto Jesus, what he's saying is, follow the leader. You are running a race. It is the race of faith, moving towards the objective. The writer of Hebrews says, as you're doing that, follow the leader. Follow the leader. You have a leader, so follow him. We find this again. I mentioned Hebrews chapter 2, verse 10. He says, bringing many sons to glory. That is his objective, the captain of our salvation, in bringing many sons to glory. We are following him to the destination. Hebrews chapter 6, verses 19 through 20. We studied this before as we got into the illustration of the boat. And that boat has an anchor that is anchored into the destination. And he is called the anchor of our soul. He is the forerunner. He is already entered into the destination to which we are headed. Peter says in 1 Peter 3:18 that Christ has also suffered for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God. All of these statements saying the same thing. He is our leader. Follow him to that destination. What we have here in this statement is a very important point of the incarnation of God in the person of the Second Trinity. And that is that God gave us a man to follow. Prophets could say, trust God and draw near to God. I can stand before you and say, trust God and draw near to God. But it is an entirely different thing to understand that God has not just said, trust me and draw near to me. God has given us a man to follow in that direction. Very difficult for us to just follow a command or a concept. It is an entirely different thing to follow an actual man. And that is who Jesus Christ is. He is the author, the archegos, the trailblazer of our faith, because he trusted his Father absolutely and perfectly. So as we have this man that God gave us to follow, God incarnate, the second person of the Trinity, we are to follow him. And that is the instruction from today's message. Follow the leader. Now, as we are following Christ, we don't do so numbly or mechanically or slavishly. This looks like a lot of fun, doesn't it? You know, like a Himalayan Sherpa carrying all the baggage behind the explorer that's going, I'm just following the leader, slavishly going along. Is that how I follow Christ? Absolutely not. That's not what he's talking about. Jesus, as the pioneer of our faith, as the trailblazer, Jesus came for a reason. He lived for a purpose. He died according to plan. And there was a point to everything he did, moving him closer to his ultimate goal. In that way, we follow Jesus. We follow in his steps. He has told us that He gave us an example that we should do as He has done, that we should walk in His steps. And so we follow Him as, say, David did from the Old Testament. David, who is a man after God's own heart. David is known for having followed God with his whole heart. Was he distracted from time to time? Yes, he was. But he still followed God. And he recognized that when he got distracted, it was the worst thing for him. The best thing for him was when he was wholeheartedly in pursuit of God. That is why he said in Psalm 63, "My soul follows close behind you." The King James reads, "My soul followeth hard after thee." My soul follows close behind you. You know what he's saying? David is saying, I am passionately in pursuit of God. Because he is the object of my pursuit. He is the object of my trust and my confidence. So what are we called to when he says here, looking unto Jesus, the archegos of our faith? The writer of Hebrews is instructing us to follow the leader, and we do so by being a student of Jesus. A student of Jesus. A student as in a disciple. What is a disciple but a committed follower? Why should we be a student of His? Because He is our preeminent example. He is our leader. He is our teacher. He is our Lord, Master, Rabbi. I like what William Dembski says. He is one of the pioneers of the intelligent design movement. William Dembski says this, Christ has assumed the fullness of our humanity and entered every aspect of our reality. He thereby renders all of our studies the study of Himself. That's a good statement. In everything that I do, I am a student of Jesus Christ, and I see the glory of God. I see His handiwork. I see what aligns with His character and purpose. I see what detracts from His character and purpose in everything that I do. Because I am a student of Jesus Christ. What we have here is some very practical Christology. Christology, theology, isn't just for our knowing. It's for our transformation. And in this command to look unto Jesus, to follow the leader, there's some very practical Christology, meaning that I will live in the outflow of what I believe. How does that look? How does that work out? Well, first of all, it's two questions very simply. And the first question is this, what did Jesus do? It's not up to me and my conjecture to try to imagine what would Jesus do if He were in my shoes doing this. It is up to me, however, to know the revelation of God and to look at what Jesus actually did. What did Jesus do? Because He said, for example, in John chapter 13, happy are you when you do what I have done. He says, I have given this to you that you should do, that you should follow my example. What exactly did He do in John chapter 13? He got down and did the work of a slave and He washed His disciples' feet. What did Jesus do? Let's consider three subpoints under that. What did Jesus do when He was tempted? You see, it's the temptation itself is not sin. Even Jesus was tempted. But what did Jesus do when He was tempted? Are you tempted? Yes, you are. On a very regular basis. You are tempted to be distracted away from what God has for you. You are tempted to be distracted and lured toward things that they want to be your satisfaction instead of God. Just as Eve was tempted in the garden. Away from God, away from His character and His purpose. You and I are tempted regularly on a daily basis. What did Jesus do when He was tempted? Or how about what did Jesus do when He was mistreated? Have you ever been mistreated? Yes, you have. If you haven't been, you will be, so just wait. What did Jesus do when He was mistreated? He was humble. He was meek. Meek does not mean weak. I mean, think about it. Who was Jesus, right? The very one who created all that is. And those that were mistreating him, at any moment of time, he could have gone, okay, I'm done with you. And they were gone. Now, in his humanity, in his willingness to follow the Father and do the Father's will, that never entered his mind. But did Jesus have the power to do that? I mean, is he not the one who calmed the waves and the wind? He is sovereign over creation. And yet he never used that sovereignty. He never used that omnipotence for his own protection. That's the definition of meekness. Okay. What did Jesus do when he was mistreated? He responded in meekness. What did Jesus do when he had a very hard thing to do? Did Jesus have a hard thing to do? Something like enduring the cross? Pretty hard thing to do. You know what? The writer of Hebrews is not referring to the pain and the anguish, the physical pain and anguish of being hung on a cross and dying of suffocation. That's not what he was referring to. He was referring to the fact that the second person of the Trinity had to be abandoned by the first person of the Trinity, a suffering that you and I will never comprehend. Jesus had to endure that, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame. He had a very hard thing to do. Why did Jesus do that? Because it was in the Father's will and purpose. It was according to the Father's character of love and grace. That's why he did it. And it was in the Father's purpose. And it pleased the Father. And Isaiah 53 says, he saw the travail of his soul and he was satisfied. That's why he did it. What did Jesus do when he was tempted, when he was mistreated, when he had a very hard thing to do? As we are students of Jesus, then we will translate in that to, what then should I do? What then do I do when I am tempted? What do I do when I am mistreated? What do I do when I have a very hard thing to do? I trust God, as Jesus did, the trailblazer of personal faith. Jesus didn't need to be saved, obviously. He is salvation. But he still had to trust his Father. You see? So that's very practical Christology for us. A second point under that, a second question that you could ask is, how does this align with his character and purpose? How does this align with his character and purpose? This, I mean, any endeavor, any motive, any attitude, the attitudes of my heart. An attitude is a habit of thought. And when I am being mistreated and I'm tempted to get into a rut, you know, what is my mood? Do you have any control over your moods? You have control over the habits of thought. You have control over the things that go through your mind. Else, Philippians 4:8 would be an invalid command in Scripture, wouldn't it? Whatever things are true, honest, just, pure, lovely, of good report, excellent, praiseworthy, do what? Meditate on these things. What is that? That's an attitude. It is a habit of thought. You, as created in the image of God, have the capacity to control what's going on in your mind. You can't empty your mind, but you can replace it with something good, something better. You see, that's what Jesus did. Did Jesus ever cry? Yes, he did. Was Jesus ever angry? Yes, he was. Did those things define him? No, they didn't. They were not mistakes. They were not flaws in his part, because his crying and his anger, all of them were directly related to the character and purpose of God and that which is contrary to it. You see, that's what it looks like to be a student of Jesus. And therefore, as I am a student of Jesus, I am looking unto Jesus as the pioneer of my faith. I remember listening to the radio one morning a couple years ago, taking my kids to school, when we took them to school. And it said, you know, the song came on the radio and the announcer came on. And sometimes I wish those announcers would just be quiet, you know. That's another story. But they say, you know, there was a good song coming on, but then the announcer said something like, "I hope the song matches the mood you're in." I'm like, really? Do I not have any control? This is the mood I am in. That's who I am. I haven't had my coffee yet, so don't you be the first person to get on my nerves today. Have I no control over that? Is Christ and His Word and His Spirit sufficient for my life, or are they not? Was Jesus defined by those kinds of moods? No. There's a lot of self-talk that goes along in a person's heart and mind. And as I am a student of Jesus, and I consider what He did, and then with my motives, even down to my mood, even down to my attitude that's formulating my mood right now, I can ask the question, does this align with God's character and purpose? Does this align with Jesus' character and His purpose? So if I find myself in the mood like I would be normally before I have my coffee in the morning, which, by the way, that really doesn't define me, but some people say it does of themselves anyway. But, you know, can you imagine Jesus saying, "I haven't had my coffee in the morning, so don't get on my nerves"? Not at all. Not at all. What was His character? It was love. It was grace. It was righteousness. What was His purpose? His purpose was a mission of reconciliation. His purpose was a passionate desire to please His Father. And so, yeah, am I going to make mistakes? Yeah. Am I going to be distracted? Absolutely, yes. But you know what? I still have this anchor of the soul, this pioneer, this trailblazer of personal faith that I can look to, and I can correct my attitude. I can correct my behavior, which is why He says, looking unto Jesus, the archegos of personal faith. So that if I find myself in a rut of a mood, I can look to Jesus and I can ask myself, what did Jesus do? And I can ask myself, how does this align with His character and His purpose? And God in His Word through His Spirit can correct me. Jesus, the pioneer of personal faith. This is why He says it's running a race. It is, isn't it? Because it takes endurance. It takes perseverance. It all comes down to understanding this, like according to that illustration that we saw earlier, if you're not following the leader, you're living in aimless circles. And how many people who are ostensibly of faith find themselves doing that day after day, week after week? They find themselves just moving in aimless circles and they end up right back where they were, feeling like they haven't progressed one single bit. Maybe it's because we don't really have our gaze fixed on Jesus. Maybe it's because we're looking more at Jesus' stuff instead of Jesus Himself. Maybe it's because we're too easily distracted by our adversity. Or maybe it's because we're too easily distracted or defined by our prosperity. You see, we need to keep our gaze fixed on Jesus, the archegos of our faith. That's what we're called to. Let's be a people living by faith, running the race with endurance, fixing our gaze on Jesus Himself and nothing else. Taking our eyes off of everything else and looking to Jesus. Turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in His wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of His glory and grace.